Hello and welcome to another episode with Living With Mental Health here today. I think we're on episode 7. I forgot to check before coming on stream. I blame my grandma because she asked me to go and get some money out for her because she's a rebel. So today I've got a truly inspirational man with me today. This bloke I first met in 2018 at a conference in a town called Lowestoft where I'm from. And we've talked ever since then, and he's done a podcast with me before when I was only doing the audio visions. His name is Dan Biddle. So, Dan, can I ask you to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So, hi, everyone. My name's Dan Biddle. I'm known as the most seriously injured survivor from the July 7 terror attacks in London back in 2005. I was on one of the tube trains when I was travelling to work that day. As a result of that terrorist attack, as a result of the bombing, I lost both my legs. I lost my left eye. I lost my spleen. I was set on fire, multiple lacerations. I spent 8 weeks in a coma. I died 3 times and had to have open heart surgery to restart my heart. I spent 12 weeks in intensive care and I spent a year in hospital. And I think the big thing for me, on top of all the physical injuries that I sustained, I was diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder, not really understanding what that was at the time. I just kind of thought, well, that's just another thing I need to kind of get to understand and live with, and I put that to the back of the queue. Not really understanding what mental health conditions were, not really understanding what PTSD was. That kind of sentiment of deal with it later really did come back and bite me in the backside in a rather bad way.
That I'm going to come back to the PTSD after I've asked my first question, Dan, because that's something they're now looking at with me, but I want to come back to that in a minute. But that my first question is to you, and you've touched on it briefly before we go into more of your story. What does mental health and mental ill health mean to you?
The only way I can really describe it, it's like, the way I look at it, it's like owning a big dog. So you can get up one morning and your dog's been really well behaved in the night, and you can take it for a walk and it will sit at every crossing point. It doesn't foul in the street. It doesn't bark at people or pull on the lead. You've got this really brilliant dog. So you think you've got it cracked. Literally the next day you can get up, there'll be dog's mess all over your house. You'll take the dog out. It's pulling everywhere. It's dragging you across the road. It's barking and snarling at people and you've got no control of it. And that's what, for me, what PTSD is. From one day to the next, I don't know what it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to do. I can wake up some days and feel on top of the world, or I can have an absolutely brilliant day, wake up the next day, and it takes every ounce of energy I've got just to get out of bed, where I feel worthless, I feel useless, I don't see the point in carrying on, I don't feel that my survival was worth it. And it's all related to the trauma that I went through. And it, I think the thing for me, the thing about mental health is twofold, really. A, it's individual. Each person that has a mental health condition will have different symptoms of it. They'll handle it differently. It'll impact on them in a different way. But second of all as well, I think it's that kind of the lack of awareness and the lack of understanding in wider society as well that can often exacerbate somebody's condition. Because when people say to me, like sometimes with my PTSD, I suffer with anxiety and depression as well. So some days I do look exactly how I feel. I look very down. I look quite sad. And people say to you, like, oh, don't worry, it might never happen. I'm not frightened of what might happen. I'm terrified of what's already happened.
Yeah.
That's why it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. It's already happened. So I think that there's those two elements, really. A, that it's individual to each person. And B, there isn't the understanding as much as there's work being done to push understanding around mental health. I still don't think we're anywhere near where we need to be.
No, definitely. I like your explanation of the dog. I've never looked at it that way, but that to me, that really hit home to me. You explaining like that, that's really interesting. Going on to PTSD, that's not my diagnosis. I'm diagnosed emotional unstable personality disorder with psychotic episodes and compulsive components. So if anybody wants me to spend their money, just send me your bank details and I'll spend it for you, because I'm brilliant at that. But as you know, I had a bit of a dip in my mental health a couple of weeks back because I've messaged you and stuff. But the bloke I saw at the Croesus calf wondered whether I've got a little bit of PTSD there, because I was talking about my, I was talking about my story to someone, and it triggered me. It never triggered me before, but I think it was because I hadn't planned on talking about my story that day. So whereas before, like if I know I'm doing something about my story or talk around my story or anything along that lines or self-harm, I can prepare myself for it.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't ready. So I think it just triggered me and think, maybe I might go back into this. And I couldn't get, I wasn't suicidal or nothing, but I was really high anxious state of mind and I could not snap out of it. My partner tried everything and we just couldn't snap me out of it. And the answer was from the mental health team is they wanted to double my meds.
So I have to take medication because of the PTSD and the depression and things like that. But I think for me as well, that medication will only do so much. Do you know what I mean? It's for me, I look at it as medication gives you that sense that you're doing okay. But I know if I stop taking my meds, I'm going to plummet. I'm going to go down here really quick. So the medication is great for giving me the stability and enabling me to function and do the things that I want to do. But you have to combine that with tackling the cause of what causes you the distress, what causes you anxiety. So for me, I went through a treatment called EMDR, which is, if I can remember the acronym for it, is Eye Movement Disassociation Reprogramming. And what that basically does, so for me with complex PTSD, the way I had it described to me is that somebody with PTSD will have triggers that take them back to their traumatic memory. They'll have there'll be something that flashes them back to it or whatever, but it takes an occurrence of something to take them back to their memory.
Yeah.
With my complex PTSD, I'm constantly trapped in my trauma. I'm constantly trapped in that traumatic memory. And I think I went through the EMDR process and what it enabled me to do, it enabled me to process that what happened to me was a past event, whereas it always felt like it was happening right now, right in that instant.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I still get that feeling. I still suffer with that. I still, as you know, John, I do a lot of talks around my experience and what I went through. And like yourself, the minute I talk about it, I can see it, I can smell it, I can taste it. I'm back there. The difference between the me now and the me, say, 10 years ago, that very prospect of doing that would render me useless for a week. I would be just in a complete mess.
Yeah.
Now it renders me useless for about 10 minutes. And I can process it, I can manage it, and I can kind of get to that next stage. And I think that the thing with medication is you have to have something in conjunction with it, because the medication can only do so much, but you also have to be able to kind of work your way through what that trauma is. Because the mistake I made, and it was a terrible thing that I did, was I treated my trauma as something I could put in a box, put a lid on, and never go to again. And I was naive in thinking that I could control it. And basically what happened, and the way my psychologist described it, was I kept putting loads of stuff in this box, and every day there was a different trauma related to the bombing that got put in the box. And eventually the box weren't big enough, so now it starts to spill over the side.
Yeah.
And then I'm still trying to squeeze more in, so even more is coming out. So that's how I noticed the deterioration, was the more I tried to squeeze the lid down, the more the lid wanted to fly off. And when it flew off, it got really messy really, really quickly. It led to three suicide attempts. I tried to kill myself three times. And that was all because I'm a proud man. I'm a stubborn sod. My missus will testify to how stubborn I am. Because of the physical injuries I sustained, and before I got blown up, I was 6'5". I was really strong, fit, muscly, and I lost all of that as a result of what happened. So to then go from being this physically fit, strong man to somebody that's disabled, that is now viewed as more weaker and vulnerable than other people, to turn around and say that I'm not mentally strong to cope with it, it dented my pride. It was like, well, what are you then? What kind of man are you if you can't deal with that? And that was my own failing, because where I thought I was using a lot of strength in not talking about it and bottling it up, actually the stronger thing to do was go to somebody and go, I can't cope with this.
Yeah.
This is actually killing me. I can't cope with it. And it was only when I met my wife, Jem, that I felt comfortable to do that. And I think that's the other thing, going back to the you said about the two things earlier on. We need to create spaces where people can be comfortable to talk about what's gone on.
Yeah, definitely. And
one of the biggest lessons I learned around mental health was, if you're talking to somebody that's struggling with their mental health, the best thing you can do is shut your mouth and open your ears.
Yeah.
Because they're not expecting you to fix them, because you can't. If we could fix everybody with mental health, then we wouldn't have mental health problems in this country.
No.
But just the ability to talk to somebody and get it off your chest, that can make the world a difference. Even Definitely. If it's a 10-minute respite, it makes the world a difference.
Totally agree there. I didn't get a good response from... when I rang up the receptionist, I got a snotty answer, So I said, look, if I don't get a phone call back by 5 p.m, do I ring the out of hours and go through the mental hotline there? And she was like, if you feel you need to.
The thing I don't understand, John, and it's something that where mental health is concerned has baffled me. It really, really has. For, as I say, before getting blown up, I had no kind of real mental health concerns or anything like that. And then obviously after getting hurt and everything that went on. But the one thing that I've come to realise with the way we treat mental health, if I fell over in the street and broke my arm, and my arm's hanging at a 90 degree angle and it's all busted up, I'm not going to look at my arm and think, you know what, I'm going to wait till I break every other bone in my body and then I'm going to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But when it comes to mental health, we seem to have this viewpoint, and I don't know if it's because the services are stretched so much or whatever, but it's almost a case of saying, well, we won't intervene until you're at crisis point. By that point, 9 times out of 10, it's too late.
Yeah, definitely.
You've lost that bit of hope that the world can get better, that it can improve. And I think it would be much more cost effective to treat people at source when you, like yourself, you knew that you weren't right and you could identify that in yourself.
Yeah.
You rang these people for help because you're at a point where you don't know where to go. Why are we then saying, well, wait and wait and wait till you're at crisis point to then have a lot more costly interventions than just having somebody to speak to and talk it through, and whatever's needed is in place there and then? I've never understood it. It seems to be the most backwards approach to mental health I've ever come across.
I totally 100 million, whatever the highest number in the world, percent agree with you there. It's ridiculous, because I feel that if someone's asking for help, whether they're not quite in a high state of crisis but feel they're going, you should be intervening there, because that just might be enough to switch them. Yes, like you said before, and I really like your point, we're all unique and individual, we're not all the same, and that one step getting involved early could be the point where someone's, oh, that was a good bit of advice I just got from that person that's helped me, I don't need this anymore. But someone else might need that. But if you're going and leaving them till they get into a higher crisis point, then the cost of, like you say, the cost effects of dealing with this person is going to be a tumbling effect.
Absolutely. And I think it's also, John, I think it's counterintuitive as well, because I think what you can propagate is a system of, you ring a mental health crisis team for support, and they just give you the brush off effectively, wait until you're in crisis. So once you've had that once, how inclined are you going to be to ring them up the next time? So is there a question to be asked around, well, actually, are we not making the situation slightly worse because we're making people feel like actually what you're going through isn't that bad, it isn't that important? Whereas to each individual person, I know when I'm at crisis point with my mental health, it's the worst possible feeling in the world to me.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that I disregard anybody else's mental health or don't treat anybody else, what they're going through, as equally as serious as what I go through. Because we're all different. We're all individuals. We all have our own levels of resilience and what we can tolerate and what we can process and what we can do. And I think where mental health's concerned, if you break an arm, there is a set treatment for that.
Yeah.
If you break your leg, there's a set treatment for that. If you've got a headache, there's a set treatment for that. mental health is different because our personalities and who we are also play a part in the levels that we go to with our mental health.
Definitely.
So we certainly need more person-centered and more immediate action around mental health when somebody reaches out. I see all this nonsense about if you can be one thing in life, be kind. Complete cobblers, to be brutally honest. It's a fashionable thing to put on a hashtag.
Yeah.
Because how many times, I can't count, I've lost count of how many times I've been somewhere and somebody said to me, are you all right? And I feel like absolute crap. And
yeah,
there's a part of me that wants to go, do you know what? Actually, I'm thinking about going home and taking as many painkillers as I could possibly find for a bottle of scotch, sticking two fingers up to the world and calling it a day. But people don't want to hear that. They want to hear, no, I'm doing all right. I'm doing fine. So if anything, if you can be anything in this world, just be genuine.
Yeah.
That would make a world of difference to people. If you're going to ask somebody how they are, mean it. Don't just use that as an off the cuff. And if you're not sure that somebody's doing all right, go, no, look, actually, are you sure you're all right? Do you want to grab a cup of coffee? 10 minutes out of your day can save someone's life.
Definitely. I can't disagree with you there. It's totally amazing. Right, next, I'm going to bring you on because I haven't seen you post about it for a while, actually. Are you still doing the wheelchair boxing?
Unfortunately, I'm still involved in an organisation called Great Britain Disability Boxing, but my shoulders are just absolutely shot to pieces. Where I've been in the chair for kind of nearly 17 years now, my rotator cuffs in my shoulders are gone, so it causes me a huge amount of discomfort to throw the punches and stuff like that. But I'm still involved in the planning and strategy around taking the sport forward. So it's an amazing thing to see when you see somebody that previously never thought it'd be possible to put on a pair of boxing gloves and hit a punch bag or do some pad work or whatever it may be. And you just see this kind of switch go on them and go, actually, I can do this.
Yeah.
Even if they can only use one arm and they've got very little strength, but there's enough to throw that punch, then you just see something kind of light in individuals. And it's an amazing thing to see. We're not about putting two disabled people in a boxing ring and letting them smash seven bells out of each other. That's not what it's about. But it is about giving people a new experience and pushing the boundaries of what people think disability really is all about. So that's the overriding ethos of what we do.
Well, I'm glad you're still in it, involved with it, even though you can't do it physically. I'm glad you're in there because you've got that mindset to change people's minds. And this brings me on to your new business. I want you just to explain about your new business venture you've gone into, because I saw a post yesterday about something and I thought it was absolutely fantastic what you did. So just explain a little bit about your business and what you aim to do from it, please.
So I've worked in what we call a disability arena for about the last 10, 12 years now. So I've done work on access audits, on making environments more accessible because my background's construction. But one of the things that's been really, really key to me is employment and the lack of opportunity for disabled people, those that are neurodivergent, those with mental health issues, to actually get into work, to find meaningful, sustainable, long-term employment. And the amount of barriers I faced over the years when I was trying and applying for jobs, and it was almost as if my wheelchair come before anything else. So it didn't matter how well qualified I was, didn't matter how experienced I was. The minute I put down that I was in a wheelchair, that was it. The opportunity was gone. And all this kind of within the Equality Act, which is obviously the legislation around discrimination, there's a part of the Equality Act that says, as a disabled person, I don't have to disclose the fact I've got a disability to an employer. I'm not legally bound to do that. Problem is, when you're a wheelchair user and you can't walk, I need to know if there's steps at the building. I need to know if there's an accessible toilet, if there's a lift. So I don't have a choice. I don't want to turn up to an interview and there's steps and I've got to sit outside like a lemon looking up going, well, now what? So what I was looking at it and during COVID doing a lot of research, I started a company called the National Diversity Employment and Advisory Service. And we've got a fully inclusive jobs board as well. So what it is, it's a recruitment agency and a recruitment consultancy specifically designed at helping disabled people get back into work or start work if they've never worked before. So we've got two elements to the business. We've got the jobs board, where we post jobs and candidates can sign up and create profiles. And what we do that's slightly different is we ask candidates to tell us what their accessibility needs are. So do they need an accessible parking space? Do they need level entry? Do they need toilets? Do they need lifts, access to lifts, guide dogs to be taken to interviews and to work? Do they need to have organisations have an understanding of neurodiversity? So they create their profile. So when an employer signs up, we ask them a set of questions. So we'll either go to the employer's premises, look at what their accessibility is, and we make a note of it, or they tell us. So when you're looking for a job, not only can you search on the job type that you want and the location you want, but also on the accessibility that you need. So if you need to find a job that has accessible parking, level entry, and an accessible toilet, and you want to work in construction, you basically put construction. I live in Wales, so I put Cardiff, and then I tick those options, and the algorithm searches for all the construction jobs in Cardiff that match my accessibility need. And then it works like TripAdvisor. So the top one will have the most matches to what I need. And if you go down the list, the matches drop down. So the idea is that you don't need to disclose the fact you've got a disability, because if you've got that information, why would you need to mention it? It's all about allowing people to focus on the interview and not be stressing about the disability that they have and how that's going to be viewed. It's also about working with organisations to understand more about disability, neurodiversity, mental health, understand the process involved, and utilising things like access to work. So we developed a program called Getting In, Staying In and Enabling. And the idea is it works for both the candidate and the employer. So as a candidate, we would work with that candidate to find out what it is that they want to do. We find out what their interests are. Does what they're interested in everyday life develop transferable skills that we can take into the workplace? We then do role investigations so they can fully understand the job that they want to do. What does that look like? What's the starting point? And then we help them build a CV. So there's no ambiguity in terms of their understanding of the role.
Yeah.
We then look at what support they may possibly need to actually once they're in work. So then the staying in part of the process is exactly that. It's developing a support plan, getting access to work support to fund whatever it is that they need to get them into work, and so that they can stay in work as well. We also have an advocacy service, because if you've got a disability and you've never ever worked in your life, it's a huge change of your daily routine.
Definitely.
It's a huge change in everything. So what we don't want is somebody that's tirelessly worked to get a job. We get them an opportunity. There's some issues with timekeeping or whatever it may be, which relates to their disability. What we don't want is employers to go, this isn't working. Ta-da, off we go. So the advocacy is, if there is any issues, either candidate or employer, they come to us, we mediate it, we find a solution, we put forward a plan, and then we kind of hopefully that enables the person to carry on their employment, as well as generating greater understanding from the employer. The enabling part is then, what does your career map look like? What do you want to achieve in your career? Where do you want it to go? We plot that out. We put milestones and different elements in it to say, right, in 6 months, if you want to be here, this is what you need to do. Let's review it in 6 months. And again, from an employer perspective, it's what does an employer need to do to attract the best diverse disabled talent? How do they retain that talent and how do they progress that talent? So we've got a support package for the candidate and a support package for the employer, all generated around this kind of full wraparound service. Because unfortunately, for employment terms for disabled people, all the focus is on what the disabled person needs to do and what they need to achieve, and nothing really on the employer side.
Yeah.
That's why the current system will never work, because it needs to be holistic. Both parties need to play an equal role in the process. So what we say is that talent is talent. Focus on the talent element. We can manage the rest. And if you want an organisation that I've spoken to, they all want to be more diverse in their recruitment. Yet they all follow the same recruitment practices they've done for the last 20 years. And it's not yielded the results they want. So if you want different outcomes, you need to do things differently. And I'm kind of trying to position my business as, well, we can be that difference that can deliver you the different and more diverse outcomes. Because there is absolutely a lack of equity in employment where disability is concerned.
Definitely. Absolutely. And I think you've hit a proper big open market there.
Yeah, the rates of disabled people in employment compared to those that don't have a disability, there's a huge gap that is widening. COVID certainly played its role in that. I think for me, one of the big drivers behind this was not only my own personal lived experience, but when the Manchester terror attacks happened, and that was predominantly targeted at children and young adults, young teenagers and adults, I had this thought that surviving a bomb blast, the level of injuries I've got, there's going to be kids that were at that concert that probably got injuries like mine. And they may have wanted to have been doctors, scientists, lawyers, whatever it may be. But now they've got a disability, the world's going to look at them differently. They're going to be treated differently. And their opportunities are going to be greatly reduced. Yet we could be stifling a youngster that in 20 years' time finds a cure for cancer, but then we're never given that opportunity because they're in a wheelchair or they walk with a prosthetic limb or whatever it may be. So why are we stifling talent when really there's so much that can be done to make employment accessible, inclusive and equitable? Then why shouldn't we? Why would anybody be happy to sit back and see this talent stifled? And really, when Manchester happened, I just thought, I survived something that nobody gave me any opportunity, really. Everyone said that I was going to die. They didn't think I'd survive
it. Yeah, I remember you saying that. Every time I've heard you speak, I remember you saying that.
Yeah, my chances of survival were very, very low, single digits. It was ridiculous. But I did. And I've gone through a lot in the last 17 years to try and get some sort of normality in my life. So with my lived experience, with my professional experience, with all the different things I've studied and researched, I thought, well, let's do something that can really make a difference. And that's the crux of my business. It's about trying to give people a level of opportunity and a level of equity that wasn't there when I got hurt, that wasn't there when I was looking for jobs. I finished my degree in hospital. I did another degree. I've studied law. I've gone through all the different professional bodies and got all the memberships to do what I need to do, and I still couldn't get a job. So for me, it was like, well, you'll have to go self-employed, but do something that matters. And this is what I chose.
That's absolutely awesome. I love it, because we took my grandma out yesterday in a wheelchair, and she hasn't been out, apart from doctors and COVID jabs, she hasn't been out properly for a good 2-3 years. And yesterday we were in the local supermarket at Morrison's, and we went to the deli counter, and the woman behind the deli counter spoke to my grandma first and not me and my partner. Do you ever find that because you're in a wheelchair, people will speak to the person either pushing you or with you? Or do you find that people will not ignore you, but they just assume that you're not all there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, you probably can't see it on the podcast, but I've got a massive scar on the front of my head as well. So, yeah, I think that there's an inherent fear. I think what we've created in this whole kind of I'm offended society that we live in, I think people are so frightened of saying the wrong thing that they'd rather say nothing.
Yeah.
So instead of engaging with somebody with a disability, they're so frightened of causing offence or causing upset that they'll talk to the person that's with them. And I get it. I mean, me and Jem go out and people will ask Jem how I'm doing, and I'm sitting right there.
Yeah.
And it is this kind of this fear of like, oh, I don't want to offend anybody. But you're actually being more offensive by treating me as if I don't exist. And I think that we've created a culture where everybody seems to be so offended by absolutely everything that instead of engaging and learning more about diversity and about diverse cultures and about disability and mental health, we go, oh, no, we can't do that because we might cause upset. Well, how upsetting do you think it is to be totally disregarded and ignored?
Definitely.
How upsetting do people think that is?
Definitely. That was just me and my partner both thanked the lady yesterday, and so did my grandma. So, and the lady turned around and went, well, I could tell she was the customer.
Yeah.
So she goes, I should do. And I am going to, I know the name of the lady that was behind the counter, and I am going to ring up Morrison's and say I want to put, not a complaint, but like praise him, because that made a big difference to my grandma.
See, the thing is as well, John, that means you're going to go back and you're going to do more shopping in Morrison's.
Yeah.
So that level of understanding you got from that staff member, that stuck with you, that stuck with your grandmother, and now you'll go back to Morrison's.
Yeah.
Now, if you have to travel an additional 10 minutes, you'll do that to go there.
Yeah, definitely.
I think one of the things that I've found as well is that if somebody doesn't have the capabilities to communicate or have the cognitive ability to process the environment they're in or understand what's going on, then the person who's with them will interject and go, yeah, look, I'm really sorry, but X, Y, and Z. There'll be that level of support there. But the baseline that I use for everything is Stephen Hawking's. If you look at the severity of Stephen Hawking's disability and kind of just, if you looked at just the visual appearance of him, 90% of people, if they didn't know where he was, would be like, oh, that poor man, what could he possibly do? Yet he was one of the most brilliant academics and astrophysicists the planet's ever seen.
Definitely.
Just because his body gave up the ghost many, many years ago, his brain was as sharp as a tack. So, and that's the whole kind of talent is talent. If you just judge something by how it's packaged, then you would never get anywhere in life. I remember when Andy Ruiz beat Anthony Joshua.
Yeah.
And everybody was like, oh, look at this geezer, massively overweight. And he was fit, he was strong, he was powerful. He became heavyweight champion of the world. Yeah, Anthony Joshua was built like a bodybuilder. Everyone wrote Andy Ruiz off.
Yeah, definitely. I remember waking up. I didn't watch it, but I remember waking up and just going back to check, see who won. And I was like, fair play to him, the underdog. I like an underdog.
The thing is, everyone went by what he looked like, not what he was capable of. And I think that is one of the reasons he won. Because everyone kind of looked at him and went, oh, he's a bit doughy, he's not very toned, he's not very trim. That didn't mean he weren't a capable fighter.
No.
Because he clearly was. He knocked out the best heavyweight there was at the time.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing for me. I keep coming back to it. Talent is talent. If you, how it's packaged is irrelevant. Where disability is concerned, my company can do all the things necessary for an organization to get the very best talent, whether that's a disabled person, whatever, neurodiverse, somebody suffering from a mental health issue. We can manage all of those processes and we can provide the best talent out there. But we live in this world again where we use our eyes to make judgments on everything. We don't spend time to talk to people or to engage or anything. We look at somebody and go, oh no, that's terrible, or that, how can they possibly do anything, whatever it may be.
Yeah
I do more in a day than I'd say most people do in a week.
I can see you doing that as well. That is going to bring me to an end, Dan, but before we end it, I just want to ask you for two bits of advice. And all it is one about setting up your business, and then what advice would you give to someone that is struggling with a mental health condition?
I'll do the first one, the setting up your own business. I think if you're looking to set up your own business, find something that you're passionate about, find something that really interests you and puts a spark inside you, because if you do something you love, you'll never work a day in your life. I love what I do. It doesn't feel like work. Nothing gives me a greater buzz than giving somebody an opportunity, seeing them grab that and seeing that opportunity flourish and that person develop and progress. I love what I do. It doesn't feel like work. I absolutely love what I do. So if you are going to set up a business, it, as much as you can, find something that you're really passionate about, find something that you're really interested about, that you're knowledgeable about, and you can build a successful business of it. Because when I'm selling my business, people are buying me as much as they're buying the company, if that makes sense. So you've got to know your stuff. You've got to be passionate and enthusiastic. That's the advice I'll give to anybody setting up looking to set up their own business. Around kind of advice for somebody that's struggling with their mental health, there was I think it was Winston Churchill said it, and it was, if you're going through hell, keep going. Because the fact is, why would you want to stop in hell? Why would anybody want to live in hell? Keep going. It's tough. There's no nice way of dressing this up. If you're struggling with your mental health, you are literally going through hell. No two ways about it. It is soul destroying. It is heartbreaking. It is painful. It is everything under the sun that could possibly make you feel at your lowest. But keep going. Because the minute you stop, you're now living in hell. Nobody wants to live there. And from somebody, and I know, as I said earlier, we're all different. We all handle things differently. I've been in that place. I've been in hell. And I was able to, with the right support and the right people around me, to come through the other side of it. Now, I don't know. I could be back in hell tomorrow, the day after, this afternoon. I'm never more than 30 seconds away from being in that dark place. But I know that if I keep pushing, I'll come through the other side of it. And it may not be tomorrow. It may not be next week. It may not be next month. But eventually, I will come out the other side of it. So my advice is, if you're going through hell, keep going. When you're having good days, cling on to them for as if your life depends on it, because when you're in that bad place, the memory of that good day and how good it's been can drag you through to know that the another good day isn't out of reach.
Definitely. Thank you ever so much, Dan. I love you so much. You're so inspirational. And I just want to say thank you for being there when I needed a chat the last couple of weeks. That's really helpful.
Anytime, John. Anytime, mate. That's what I'm here for.
I will, people and listeners, I will see you in the next one.